Hello, I'm Callum McLeod, Policy Director for Community Land Scotland. Welcome to this series of conversational podcasts which explore issues around community empowerment and land decisions in Scotland today. In each podcast, two participants will chew over the issues that are most important to them and their communities and offer testimony of their experiences, reflections and perspectives. They come from many different perspectives but share a few elements in common. Firstly, they are from communities based in Scotland's sparsely populated rural areas, where depopulation has been, and often remains, a critical issue. Secondly, they are involved in what we might loosely call community empowerment, and in exploring what that means and what we need to do to enhance that. Thirdly, all the podcasts are about people's experiences of cultures of decision-making. In other words, their experiences of how decisions about the land are made in practice. Community Land Scotland is committed to supporting the community ownership of land and assets to be a significant driver of sustainable development across the whole of Scotland, and to creating a space for testimonies like this to be recorded, heard and learned from. We're delighted to be working with other members of the Community Empowerment and Land Decisions Network to bring you these podcasts. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Hello, my name's Agnes Rennie. I'm currently chair of the Urasaur of Gousing Golson Estate Trust Board, and we're here today in Golson at my home in the village of Golson to have this conversation.
Hello, my name is Sally Reynolds and I am the development manager with Urasaur of Gousing Carloway Estate Trust, which covers the area from Colonish to Carloway. I also live in the village of Golson, and I'm here with Agnes today to have a conversation about landscape decisions and how they've affected us. Today, it is the 20th of October, 2021. It is a very, very brief day in Golson, but we're tucked up nice and cosy, having a cup of coffee and a chat. So I think if we go a little bit historical to start, Agnes, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm not born and bred from the village of Golson. I was born in the village of South Dill, which is 4 miles north. But Agnes is born and bred in Golson. So, and she probably remembers more about pre-community land ownership than I do, although I do remember it. So I guess we could start by talking about that.
Yeah, I think actually it's quite interesting to see how, you know, different generations will have a different perspective on it. I live actually on a croft in the village of Golson, as indeed you do. And I think it's worth mentioning that this is a village that was cleared at the time of the Highland Clearances. And so the fact that this village is now part of the trust owned by the community, I often feel it's history gone full circle. And I'm very, very mindful that, you know, as I see the next generation, yourself and, you know, my own daughters taking an interest and indeed working for trusts, it's amazing to see how that does give you a different perspective. And I also think, although this doesn't take away in any way from community-owned land that is not croft land, but I think irrespective of private or community ownership, living on a crofting land which is governed by crofting legislation does give the people who live on that land a relationship with the land, which is different.
Yeah, and an opportunity to be involved in the decisions, which is different to other land.
Indeed. And it's worth mentioning there that at the moment, you yourself, you're the township clerk.
Yeah.
Such an honorary position, which brings no headaches, as these always do. And I held that role for a number of years. And that also, when it comes to absolutely local decision-making, as far as land and land-based issues within areas in these communities, is really quite powerful.
And for me, and This is a personal view. I feel that part of the reason we've seen so much community land ownership in area, in crofting areas that sort of started, that kicked it off, shall we say, is partly as a result of that. It's partly as a result of already having these crofting structures where decisions, people had a say in the land. So it was almost like it was an obvious next step to take over full ownership and to have a next layer of governance that made sense, because we were used to things like committees and chairs and minutes and all those kind of things. So do you feel that's connected? I always feel it is a bit, but maybe I'm making a connection that's not really there.
No, funnily enough, I kind of ask myself that question too, because I think it is a natural connection.
Yeah.
And I think if you've been part of that process, and certainly traditionally, every crofter in a township would have to take their turn on the committee.
Yeah.
As you and I know, to our cost, that is no longer the case unusually. And part of that is because actually the amount of administration that's involved in the job nowadays is very different from what it would have been 40 years ago, for example. But nevertheless, it is a huge opportunity to be involved in decision making, because not only is it decision making at our own hand in terms of the township, it's also that you're part of that process that the Crofters Commission involves you in. So immediately you have an engagement with others outside your own area.
Yeah, and I guess you, we've just replaced a boundary fence between us and the next village. And it was actually just today the check got dropped off from the other village for their share, having completed the process, accessed the grant, sorted all the monies out, and then they're paying their balance. So I guess you've got to work with a grazing clerk from another village. You've got to sort all that out. We work together to clear it. And we used contractors to build a new fence. But I guess it gives you that confidence that you can go to other groups and say, this is what we are doing. This is what we've agreed. This is the process. This is the forms we need to fill in. This is the signatures we need, and so on and so forth, which I guess people would have had here prior to going for community ownership, which possibly in other places they wouldn't have had.
Yeah, and I think that is a large part of why so many of that new wave, if you like, of community-owned trusts were in the crofting areas,
yeah,
of the Northwest Highlands and Islands. That's not to say that I don't recognise, and I'm sure you do too, it doesn't matter how much, you know, a township or an area has been, within that crofting structure over many, many generations. Unless at this moment in time there's capacity within the community, unless there is human resource within the community, then I think it's wrong to push a community beyond what they're capable of.
100%. And I think community ownership is not for every community. Some don't want it. Some, as you say, they don't have human resource, or they don't have the community confidence to move forward with it. And I think it's amazing to see the kind of wave of community ownership now, and especially into kind of urban areas. And it's been fantastic to see that. But you can also see, as they're planning, you know, it was kind of easy for us to work out. Like in Carloway, we had six townships, and all six townships were represented on the first steering group to go forward for community ownership, and majority were clerks, and we still have most of those townships either clerk or committee member on the board of directors. Not all of them now, but we have a direct and working relationships obviously with them on a daily basis. But you can see those kind of structures have to be organised and sorted out in urban areas, and you have to plan how you're going to do that. So I think it's just been a natural start, but I hope it's been a learning curve and a good example that's then spreading to other areas, and as you say, where it's appropriate.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the where it's appropriate is really important. I think it's really exciting. I don't know how you feel about it, but yeah, I think it's really exciting to see how it has spread. I think it's really exciting to see different communities being inspired by other communities.
Yeah, and I think, well, Galston and Carloway are quite a good they're quite good ones to compare because they are so different.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they're on scale, they are just completely different.
Yes.
And possibly in terms of human resource. And actually, I would say in terms of crofting, because I think it's very, very different. It's actually a very different style of crofting between the two different areas. And you can see, again, that then influences into the community land ownership. When you look back at the original kind of consultations to do with Carloway, they are all to do, the majority of the feedback and the goals were to do with crofting.
One of the things that I always remember is when we first started, well, kind of not the very beginning, but as the early consultations were clearly progressing to next stage, one of the things that came up over and over again at community meetings was from crofters. And that was a real concern as to how their status as crofters would continue once the community became the landowners, essentially. Because oddly, for many people, it felt much easier, it felt better for them, they thought, to deal with this faceless landlord represented by a factor. And that was all they had to do with it. And so the phrase sometimes used was, you know, having your neighbours prying in your business. And so there had to be big, big assurances given that actually what was being put in place would be at least as good, if not better. And ultimately, their situation would actually be continue as it was on an individual basis, because the law that protected them was enshrined in law.
Yeah, and one thing we've had, it's not so much about confidentiality. We've never had any kind of concerns about confidentiality, although we are very, we make sure that that is always maintained and respected because it wouldn't be correct in small communities. But one thing we often get asked is, will it be a lot slower? Like, will a decision be a lot slower because it's a committee instead of one person? And I say, well, not in terms of the landowner. Like, I can't speak for outside, you know, influences, but not in terms of us. We deal with things very quickly. It's dealt with by a subgroup, and you know, and we have processes. So if it's a standard procedure that's happened before, it goes to a subgroup, and once we have two yeses, if it's standard, that's it. We go ahead, and we know it's fine. You know, things don't get held up as, but that's people's main concern, that things that it's going to be like, well, your meetings are monthly, so does that mean if I happen to put a form in on the day after, I'm going to get delayed, you know? So I think it's that kind of thing. But it is amazing, very quickly people get used to just popping into the office when they're thinking of doing something, and I think then they sort of feel a reassurance then that they can move things forward. But it takes, it does take a wee while, and yeah, I think people do have that feeling that will they just become a bit slower, or I think they do worry about people talking or whatever, but you have to deal with everything professionally and confidentially. And
absolutely. And in terms of what you said there just earlier, Sally, about even within an Isle of Lewis context, mm-hmm. that there's a big difference between, you know, what people will expect in Carloway Estate mm-hmm. and what they'll expect in Galson Estate. Actually, the fact that we're now community owned will mean that dealing with these things will be very much reflected in terms of the community.
Yeah, and it's interesting as well. We've been having, so Community Land Outer Hebrides obviously covers the majority of community landowners in the Outer Hebrides are members of a new kind of umbrella organisation that was just constituted this year called Community Land Outer Hebrides. And as part of that, we've been having conversations about, and many of you will have heard about peatland restoration and carbon credits. It's a really hot topic just now. And we've been talking about how to deal with it. And interestingly, we're going to have a seminar on it in a couple of weeks for all the members of staff who deal with this particular issue to come together and talk. And what I've been hearing from my peers who do similar jobs to me is we must all do the same. So the community landowners want to make sure they're kind of having the conversations to make sure, yes, it's got to suit our communities, but equally we need to make sure we're being fair across. And I think that's really powerful because I don't know that that would have necessarily happened in the past. So if something's enshrined in law, that's easy. But if it's not, or you're just at the beginning of something like this that will probably become enshrined in law, when you've got nothing to refer to, you've got no land court documents to say that's what happened then, it's really good that people are working together. And I hope that is what will happen. I hope we'll kind of all do the same across them all.
It's interesting, I think, too, you know, I don't know if, in terms of our conversation today, you are the manager in Carloway, and I chair the board in Galston. So one of the things that I think is hugely powerful is where the relationship between the staff in a trust and the board is good and works well. Now, I totally understand that that's not always the case. And because, you mentioned, Community Land Outer Hebrides. I'm also involved in Community Land Scotland. And that's really given me a perspective of what's happening across Scotland, as I'm sure you get from your involvement in the Land Commission.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, so it's I've always thought it was really useful to have that kind of broader perspective when you're looking at your own situation. But what I think, you know, I think in terms of just looking at our own immediate experience, if you like, when you begin to talk about land and when we begin to talk about what you do with the land and how you can use the land, if the board as a board have some vision, but the relationship that they have with the people that they work with is such that they can give you, for example, the space to go out there and talk to your peers, I think it just kind of opens so many doors.
Yeah, and I think it's really reassuring for boards to know that we're getting that kind of, we're doing that kind of double checking and working together and kind of bouncing stuff off each other and making sure that we are kind of, because when something's new or old, but when something's new to you, as it is, and honestly, every day is a school day of my job, it's really important to speak to other people, discover their experiences. And sometimes it won't fit. Sometimes different communities are different and you do things a bit differently. But a lot of times it's really good to speak to other trusts and learn about their experience and what you've thought of, they might not have thought of, and vice versa. So the Community Land Outer Hebrides meetings so far have been really powerful, the network meetings, and I'm looking forward to the next one. So we recently had one on housing, which is another topic that is really difficult and very different for every community, but probably something that's on the agenda of every community landowner.
Absolutely.
The length and breadth of the country.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that actually raises something that was going through my mind there as you were speaking. And that is, it's really interesting in terms of the makeup of boards, how when you get somebody coming onto the board who has not been involved in crofting, and you know that they actually have something probably quite powerful to contribute, but their sense might be from looking at the board of a community land trust. You know, these words are quite significant, the land being probably the most significant. The number of times that people have said to me, I don't really know very much about land. Land is not something I know very much about. And then very quickly they find themselves at a board meeting where you discuss housing, where you discuss tourism, where you discuss, now, let's face it, increasingly, the whole climate change situation. And suddenly everybody's got something to contribute.
Mm-hmm. Or things like HR or policies, or we've got our annual review of policies at our next meeting. So that's something that still has to be, all of that stuff still has to be done, because you still have to run good organisations. And I think people forget about that when they're thinking about going on the board and what they've got to, what they've got to offer. But absolutely, housing touches everyone. So, and these kind of experiences are really important. And the Land Commission has done quite a lot to do with kind of land use decision making and protocols, and how, what do landowners do to make sure that the community can contribute to those decision making. So what do you think Galson, is so Urusei Galson, do for that? So I find it really difficult to answer for Urusei Galson. Although I know we do a lot, I actually find it's really hard to write it down or answer like that.
Oh, I would find it hard to write down too, yeah. I must say. And part of the reason for that, I think, is because it's quite organic.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
It's really quite organic. But having said that, we do have a strategic plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As indeed you do.
Yeah.
And we're revisiting our strategic plan at the moment to coincide with our 15th anniversary, which will be happening in January, which I can hardly believe is happening in January.
I actually noticed today, just coincidentally, I was looking at the document, I noticed today there's 10 years exactly between when Galson set up their company and when Carlow set up their company. Nothing to do with necessarily buying the land, but when their company's house kind of registered.
Yeah.
I thought, jinx, what am I? That's kind of...
It's incredible, isn't it? It really is. But, so I think you certainly need some kind of frame to work within.
Yeah.
And I think in answering that question, Sally, you know, what do we do? Well, I think one of the things we do, absolutely do, and as far as possible, we need to take the community with us in doing that, is agree the strategic objectives that we work towards and hope that these reflect as far as it's possible, you know, the things that the community wants for itself. And that absolutely includes land, no question.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's interesting because, obviously when you put that first kind of, your most recent strategic plan together, that was a kind of year of community engagement to form that, wasn't it?
Yeah.
10-year.
Yeah.
Yeah. And ours was the same. Ours was formed following a kind of exercise after the AGM and an exercise where we went into the school. But what I find really... and these kind of things are kind of easy to document and easy to talk about, and you've got your structures, and that's really, really important to have that kind of structured engagement. But I think the stuff that's really hard to document is, so for me, I was talking about this recently at an event and somebody was kind of pointing out the irony to me, which I hadn't realised. So on rent collection day this year, so we still have the same rent collection day that was always the rent collection day. It was the day after I started in the job, I think, back in 2015. It was either, I might have started on the Monday and it was the Wednesday, or I started on the Tuesday and it was the Wednesday, was going round to collect the rent with the dearly missed Simon Fraser, who was the factor, and the company, Andrew MacArthur, still factors for us, and so he remained their factor until he passed away. And he, we went around to collect the rents, as we always had done, and in the same places. And I continued to do that then from 2016 onwards. We didn't do it last year because of COVID, so we didn't have a rent collection. But we did this year, and we really didn't know what to do. And we decided to go ahead and do it outdoors. So I went to all the same places, so all the same village halls, and a meeting house, and went outside with my car, and I was there in the car park to collect the rents at the same time as normal, and that was fine. And people came to speak to me, and they pay their rent. Not only do they pay the rent, they might buy an angling ticket, they might speak to me about something, they might ask me to check something up, they might say, oh, I submitted us something for that, can you have a look at it? Or there's someone new moved in, I'd like a membership form for them. You know, so it's a really good opportunity for people. I'm out in the community, and although I would normally be in the office and they can find me, I think it's just an opportunity to come and speak to me and have that little bit of engagement and everything else. And somebody was just pointing out to me, it was And he turned to me, was actually just at a recent event pointing out to me the irony of that, that rent collection day has now become an opportunity where you go out to the community and you speak to them and they speak to you. Whereas in the past, rent collection would have been an emotionally charged and really, really difficult day, and possibly the only day of the year that you saw your factor or your landlord. So I had kind of not really thought about that because it's now so important and it's now all about chat and, you know, just a nice social occasion and an opportunity. So it's really interesting. And I think it's those kind of things that we can sometimes not know how to document, but they're really, really valuable and really, really important.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's these things that can't be documented that are probably as important as anything.
Yeah, and it's people who will come and speak to you on that day that might not come to an event, or might not come to an online event, or they might not come to a event in a village hall, a public meeting feeling, but they'll come and happily talk to me at the boot of my car while I'm doing their receipt.
it's quite interesting. I've been really surprised to see how the level of inquiries and business, what we call Croft Estate business, has continued all through COVID.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hardly dropped off at all.
No.
And that's where we of course lost our office through that dreadful fire a couple of years ago. So we've been kind of homeless since then, although we did have a temporary base. And that actually was further compounded by COVID in terms of people not quite knowing where to find us. But that hasn't meant that the level of inquiries and business going ahead has dropped off. It's been quite remarkable to me how that has continued. And as we kind of look forward with some anticipation to our new building opening for, you know, staff being back quite soon, I hope that people will feel, you know, that they can, that the door is open.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the other thing. It's something we talk about a lot, and we do actually document that it's in the place that we have an open door policy, that pop in and see us. And that's, you might not always get to see me, or you might not always get to see us, but pop in and, you know, pop in and whatever you've got to talk about, just come to the office. It's an open door policy to come and speak to us. And I guess you look forward to having that very soon.
Well, absolutely. I mean, really within days, I hope. But the fact that, you know, the fact that it's possible to do that is hugely important. And I think people do appreciate it.
They really do appreciate it. What we've done is we're open just 2 days a week at the moment following COVID, with one member of staff in at a time, 2 days apart, to kind of allow for COVID. And we obviously have COVID measures in place. And I will say that we haven't seen the same number of people come back. And for a completely different reason to yourself, it's not the same reason, our current office is being refurbished. So we are also in a temporary accommodation just around the corner from our normal office. And I don't think that has affected it. I think COVID has changed people's perspective of popping in or coming physically to see us, but it hasn't stopped them phoning or emailing. So we've seen an increase in that, an increase of inquiries through our website, actually, which we've always had an inquiry form on our website, and all of a sudden it's used a lot more regularly, which is great. So people are using different methods of contacting us, but I think they still do contact us. But I think it'll come back in time. People will pop back in more in time.
Yeah, I think it will. And I think as people become more, you know, just assured that their own personal safety isn't being, you know, kind of affected by that, as people go out more for doing different things. But just kind of before we can talk for hours, Sally, you and I, about this topic, but I just wonder where you yourself feel at the moment, you know, we as community landlords should be in the whole kind of climate change discussion, and you know, should we be leaders? Should we set example? Do we even have a role, or are people looking to us to give some leadership in this within the communities?
Well, we probably have to be leaders. We 100% have a role because land is so important in tackling the climate emergency. We're having those conversations. And I do think people in the community will look to us. I think naturally, I think community organisations have probably been ahead of their time in terms of the projects they've done. A variety of projects that Galston have worked on, a variety of projects that Carla we've worked on, and actually projects we've done together as two organisations. So I certainly think there's no chance they're not going to look to us for it. But I guess what's so important is that we ensure this just transition, and we ensure that the community are involved in those decisions and the community are treated fairly in it. And I think that's probably where we come in. And these are big questions and big discussions that are going to...
They're big questions and they're big challenges.
Yeah.
And I think what I myself feel, and quite interesting when we discussed this as a board recently, I found it really reassuring to hear people's engagement in the discussion as a board. And that is that there's actually real opportunity.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. There's challenges, but there's definitely opportunities for communities. Yeah. And we see that with all sorts of things. The proposed offshore wind that we're working on together, we just had a conversation about that just before we started.
Absolutely.
There is so much, there is big opportunities. And I definitely think, I actually think COVID has changed. So I know the same with Galston and Cardaway. We were kind of seen, remember the term that was
used? Anchor organisations.
Yes, anchor organisations. And I think we were sort of seen as the umbrella organisation that kind of brought everything together to kind of check that the gaps were being filled and that things were okay and community organisations could kind of come together to work together. And funnily enough, I don't think we're going to shake that.
I think you're absolutely right, Sally. I think that is right. And I think what it did show was that where you truly have an organisation that is pan-community.
Yeah.
And that people you don't have to wear the colours particularly, but that you can take comfort from the fact and enjoy the benefit of that organisation being there. And an organisation that can respond quickly.
Yeah, respond. And I think people are going to look to us the same with the climate emergency as they have as they did with COVID. Very quickly look to us to sort things out.
Well, the truth is, if there's going to be a kind of real local response to it, how else do you do it?
Yeah, how else do you coordinate it?
Let's face it.
Yeah, because it has to be at a scale. Let's see. And I do know, again, we are, that Community Land Out of Hebrides is feeding into those island-wide and probably even wider conversations again. So that's another strength that we can work together on it.
Yeah, and I think that absolutely is a good place to finish this bit of our conversation before we make the next cup of coffee, Sally, is... I think as community landlords, the willingness... to work together, there is no competition. There's no need to kind of create barriers and boundaries where none exist, because ultimately, the kind of the goals we have, the ambitions we have for our own communities, we share a lot of them with other communities, but we do what's best for our own community, and we know that by working with others, we can make it all the stronger.
100%, and no two communities are the same. So, but. It's worked for our community where we live. It's worked for the community where I work, and I hope it will work for many more.
Absolutely, and I think it's hugely satisfying.
Yeah.
I continue to be really impressed every day by the commitment that the people who work for us, with us, I should say, in Galston have. For the trust and the work that the trust does, and I think that's just it speaks volumes in terms of you create an organisation and you allow people to deliver, and if you get community response, then it's very satisfying.
It's fantastic, and I think the board members should be absolutely congratulated on the work they do and the time and effort and energy they put in on a voluntary basis.
Thank you very much, Sally. That's a good place to stop.
Yeah.
I'm Annie Tindley, a historian of land issues at Newcastle University. And on behalf of the network, we hope you enjoyed this conversation and be sure to tune into the rest of the series. If you'd like to find out a bit more on the participants, the podcast series and the network of community groups, organisations, policymakers and researchers that has set it up, please visit www.landdecisions.org. Our aim is to influence future thinking on cultures of decision making. That is how decisions about the land are made in practice so that people are better able to take part in decisions that affect them. Our work is therefore directed towards politicians and policymakers, government and public bodies, but most importantly, communities of place and interest who have already acquired land or are planning to do so in the future. Please join us again soon.